The Treatise on Indwelling Sin by Dr. John Owen, Chapter 9. The Deceit of Sin, in drawing off the mind from a due attendance to special duties of obedience, illustrated in meditation and prayer. How sin by its deceit endeavors to draw off the mind from attending to that holy frame and walking with God in which the soul should be preserved, has been declared. Now, we want to show how it does the same work in reference to the special duties by which the designs, workings, and prevalency of it may in a special manner be obviated and prevented. Sin indeed maintains an enmity against all duties of obedience, or rather with God in them. When I would do good, says the Apostle, evil is present with me. Whenever I would do good, or what good soever I would do, that is, spiritual good, good in reference to God, it is present with me to hinder me from it, to oppose me in it. And on the other side, all duties of obedience lie directly against the actings of the law of sin. For as the flesh in all its actings lusts against the Spirit, so the Spirit in all its actings lusts against the flesh. And therefore, every duty performed in the strength and grace of the Spirit is contrary to the law of sin. Romans 8, verse 13. If you through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the flesh, actions of the Spirit of grace and duties does this work. These two are contrary, but yet there are some duties which, in their own nature and by God's appointment, have a peculiar influence into the weakening and subduing the whole law of sin and its very principles and chiefest strengths. And these the mind of a believer ought principally in his whole course to attend to. And these does sin in its deceit endeavor principally to draw off the mind from. As in diseases of the body, some remedies, they say, have a specific quality against distempers, so in this disease of the soul, there are some duties that have a special virtue against a sinful distemper. I shall not insist on many of them, but instance only in two, which seem to me to be of this nature, namely that by God's designation they have a special tendency towards the ruin of the law of sin. And then we shall show the ways, methods, and means which the law of sin uses to divert the mind from a due attendance to them. Now these duties are, first, prayer, especially private prayer, and secondly, meditation. I put them together because they much agree in their general nature and end, differing only in the manner of their performance. For by meditation I intend meditating upon what respect and suitableness there is between the Word and our own hearts, to this end that they may be brought to a more exact conformity. It is our pondering on the truth as it is in Jesus to find out the image and representation of it in our own hearts. And so it has the same intent with prayer, which is to bring our souls into a frame in all things answering the mind and will of God. They are as the blood and spirits in the veins that have the same life, motion, and use. But yet because persons are generally at a great loss in this duty of meditation, having declared it to be of so great efficacy for the controlling of the actings of the law of sin, I shall in our passage give briefly two or three rules for the directing of believers to a right performance of this great duty, and they are these. Number one, meditate of God, with God, that is, when we would undertake thoughts and meditations of God, His excellencies, His properties, His glory, His majesty, His love, His goodness, let it be done in a way of speaking unto God in a deep humiliation and abasement of our souls before Him. This will fix the mind and draw it forth from one thing to another, to give glory to God in a due manner and affect the soul until it be brought into that holy admiration of God and delight in Him which is acceptable to Him. My meaning is that it be done in a way of prayer and praise, speaking to God. Number two, meditate on the Word, in the Word, that is, in the reading of it, consider the sense in the particular passages we insist on, looking to God for help, guidance, and direction, and the discovery of His mind and will in it, and then labor to have our hearts affected with it. Number three, What we come short of in our evenness and constancy in our thoughts in these things, let it be made up in frequency. Some are discouraged because their minds do not regularly supply them with thoughts to carry on their meditations through the weakness or imperfection of their inventions. Let this be supplied by frequent returns of the mind to the subject proposed to be meditated upon, in which new senses will still be supplied to it. But this, by the way, these duties, I say, amongst others, for we have only chosen them for an instance, not excluding some others from the same place, office, and usefulness with them, to make an especial opposition to the very being and life of indwelling sin, or rather faith in them, does so. They are perpetually designing its utter ruin. I shall, therefore, upon this instance, in the pursuit of our present purpose, do these two things. Number one, show the suitableness and usefulness of this duty, or these duties, as I shall handle them jointly, to the ruining of sin. Number two, show the means in which the deceitfulness of sin endeavors to draw off the mind from a due attendance to them. For the first, observe that it is a proper work of the soul in this duty to consider all the secret workings and actings of sin, what advantages it has gotten, what temptations it is in conjunction with, what harm it has already done, and what it is yet further ready to do. Hence David gives that title unto one of his prayers, Psalm 102, a prayer of the afflicted when he is overwhelmed and pours out his complaint before the Lord. I speak of that prayer which is attended with a due consideration of all the wants, straits, and emergencies of the soul. Without this, prayer is not prayer. That is, whatever show or appearance of that duty it has, it is no way useful, either to the glory of God or the good of the souls of men. A cloud it is without water, driven by the wind of the breath of men. Nor was there ever any more present and effectual poison for souls found out than the binding of them unto a constant form and usage of I know not what words in their prayers and supplications which themselves do not understand. Bind men so in their trades or in their businesses in this world, and they will quickly find the effect of it. By this means are they disenabled from any due consideration of what at present is good for them or evil unto them, without which to what use can prayer serve but to mock God and delude men's own souls. But in this kind of prayer which we insist on, the Spirit of God falls in to give us his assistance, and that in this very manner of finding out and discovering the most secret actings and workings of the law of sin, Romans 8, verse 26. We know not what we should pray for, as we ought, but he helps our infirmities. He discovers our wants unto us, and wherein chiefly we stand in need of help and relief. And we find it by daily experience that in prayer believers are led into such discoveries and convictions of the secret deceitful work of sin in their hearts, as no considerations could ever have led them into. So David, Psalm 51, designing the confession of his actual sin, having his wound in his prayer searched by the skillful hand of the Spirit of God, he had a discovery made unto him of the root of all his miscarriages and his original corruption. Verse 5. The Spirit in this duty is as a candle of the Lord unto the soul, enabling it to search all the inward parts of the belly. It gives a holy spiritual light into the mind, enabling it to search the deep and dark recesses of the heart, to find out the subtle and deceitful machinations, figments, and imaginations of the law of sin therein. Whatever notion there be of it, whatever power and prevalency in it, it is laid hand on, apprehended, brought into the presence of God, judged, condemned, bewailed. And what can possibly be more effectual for its ruin and destruction? For together with its discovery, application is made unto all that relief which in Jesus Christ is provided against it, all ways and means in which it may be ruined. Hence it is the duty of the mind to watch unto prayer, 1 Peter 4:7, to attend diligently to the state of our souls and to deal fervently and effectually with God about it. The like also may be said of meditation, wisely managed to its proper end. Number two, in this duty there is worked upon the heart a deep, full sense of the vileness of sin, with a constant renewed detestation of it, which, if anything, undoubtedly tends to its ruin. This is one design of prayer, one end of the soul in it, namely to draw forth sin, to set it in order, to present it unto itself in its vileness, abomination, and aggravating circumstances, that it may be loathed, abhorred, and cast away as a filthy thing, as Isaiah 30, verse 22. He that pleads with God for sin's remission pleads also with his own heart for its detestation. Hosea 14, verse 3. In this also sin is judged in the name of God for the soul in his confession, subscribes to God's detestation of it, and the sentence of his law against it. There is indeed a course of these duties which convince persons to give up themselves to as a mere covert to their lusts. They cannot sin quietly unless they perform duty constantly. But that prayer we speak of is a thing of another nature, a thing that will allow no composition with sin, much less will serve the ends of the deceit of it, as the other, formal prayer, does. It will not be bribed into a secret compliance with any of the enemies of God or the soul, no, not for a moment. And hence it is that oftentimes in this duty the heart is raised to the most sincere, effectual sense of sin and detestation of it that the soul ever obtains in its whole course of obedience. And this evidently tends also to the weakening and ruin of the law of sin. Number 3. This is a way appointed and blessed of God to obtain strength and power against sin. James 1 verse 5. Does any man lack? Let him ask of God. Prayer is a way of obtaining from God by Christ a supply of all our wants, assistance against all opposition, especially that which is made against us by sin. This, I suppose, need not be insisted on. It is in the notion and practice clear to every believer. It is that wherein we call and upon which the Lord Jesus comes into our succor with suitable help in time of need, Hebrews 4, verse 16. Fourthly, faith and prayer countermines all the workings of the deceit of sin, and that because the soul does in it constantly engage itself to God to oppose all sin whatsoever. Psalm 119, 106, I have sworn and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments. This is the language of every gracious soul in its addresses to God. The inmost parts thereof engage themselves to God to cleave to him in all things and to oppose sin in all things. He that cannot do this cannot pray. To pray with any other frame is to flatter God with our lips, which he abhors. And this exceedingly helps a believer in pursuing sin to its ruin. For first, if there be any secret lust that lies lurking in the heart, he will find it either rising up against its engagement or using its artifices to secure itself from it. And by this it is discovered, and the conviction of the heart concerning its evil furthered and strengthened. Sin makes the most certain discovery of itself, and never more evidently than when it is most severely pursued. Lusts in men are compared to hurtful and noisome beasts, or men themselves are so because of their lusts. Isaiah 11, verses 4 to 6. Now such beasts use themselves to their dens and coverts, and never discover themselves, at least so much in their proper nature and rage as when they are most earnestly pursued. And so it is with sin and corruption in the heart. Secondly, if any sin be prevalent in the soul, it will weaken it, and take it off from the universality of this engagement to God. It will breed a tergiversation unto it, a slightness in it. Now when this is observed, it will exceedingly awaken a gracious soul and stir it up to look about it. As spontaneous lassitude or a causeless weariness and indisposition of the body is looked on as a sign of an approaching fever or some dangerous distemper, which stirs up men to use a timely and vigorous prevention, that they be not seized upon by it, so is it in this case. When the soul of a believer finds in itself an indisposition to make fervent, sincere engagements of universal holiness to God, it knows that there is some prevalent distemper in it, finds a place of it, and sets itself against it. Thirdly, while the soul can thus constantly engage itself to God, it is certain that sin can rise to no ruinous prevalency. Yea, it is a conquest over sin, a most considerable conquest, when the soul does fully and clearly without any secret reserve come off with alacrity and resolution in such an engagement, as Psalm 18, verse 23. And it may upon such a success triumph in the grace of God, and have good hope through faith that it shall have a final conquest. And what it so resolves shall be done, that it has decreed a thing, and it shall be established, and this tends to the disappointment, yea, to the ruin of the law of sin. Fourthly, if the heart be not deceived by cursed hypocrisy, this engagement to God will greatly influence it to a peculiar diligence and watchfulness against all sin. There is no greater evidence of hypocrisy than to have the heart like the whorish woman, Proverbs 7, verse 14, to say, I have paid my vows, now I may take myself unto my sin, and to be negligent about sin, as being satisfied that it has prayed against it. It is otherwise in a gracious soul. Sense and conscience of engagements against sin made to God do make it universally watchful against all its motions and operations. On these and a number of other accounts does faith in this duty exert itself peculiarly to the weakening of the power and stopping of the progress of the law of sin. If then the mind be diligent in its watch and charge to preserve the soul from the efficacy of sin, it will carefully attend to this duty and a due performance of it, which is of such singular advantage to its end and purpose. Here, therefore, number two, sin puts forth its deceit in its own defense. It labors to divert and draw off the mind from attending to this and the like duties. And there are, among others, three engines, three ways and means in which it attempts the accomplishment of its design. Number one, it makes advantage of its weariness to the flesh. There is an aversion, as has been declared in the law of sin, unto all immediate communion with God. Now this duty is such, there is nothing accompanying it in which the carnal part of the soul may be gratified or satisfied, as there may be somewhat of that nature in most public duties and most that a man can do beyond pure acts of faith and love. No relief or advantage, then, coming in by it, but what is purely spiritual. It becomes wearisome, burdensome to flesh and blood. It is like traveling alone without companion or diversion, which makes the way seem long, but brings the passenger with most speed to his journey's end. So our Savior declares, when expecting his disciples according to their duty and present distress, should have been engaged in this work, he found them fast asleep, Matthew 26, verse 41. The Spirit, he says, indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And out of that weakness grows their indisposition to and weariness of their duty. So God complains of his people, Isaiah 43, 22. You have become weary of me. And it may come at length to that height which is mentioned, Malachi 1, verse 13. You have said, behold, what a weariness is it, and you have snuffed at it, says the Lord of hosts. The Jews supposed that it was the language of men when they brought their offerings or sacrifice on their shoulders, which they pretended wearied them, and they panted and blowed as men ready to faint under them, when they brought only the torn and the lame and the sick. But so is this duty oftentimes to the flesh. And this the deceitfulness of sin makes use of, to draw the heart by insensible degrees from a constant attendance to it. It puts in for the relief of the weak and weary flesh. There is a compliance between spiritual flesh and natural flesh in this manner. They help one another, and an aversion to this duty is the effect of their compliance. So it was in the spouse, Song of Solomon 5, verse 2. She was asleep, drowsing in her spiritual condition, and pleads her natural unfitness to rouse herself from that state. If the mind be not diligently watchful to prevent insinuations from this, if it doesn't dwell constantly on those considerations which evidence an attendance to this duty to be indispensable, if it does not stir up the principle of grace in the heart to retain its rule and sovereignty, and not to be dallied with by foolish pretenses, it will be drawn off, which is the effect aimed at. Number two, the deceitfulness of sin makes use of corrupt reasonings taken from the pressing and urging occasions of life. Should we, it says in the heart, attend strictly to all duties in this kind, we should neglect our principal occasions and be useless unto ourselves and others in the world. And on this general account, particular businesses dispossess particular duties from their due place and time. Men have not leisure to glorify God and save their own souls. It is certain that God gives us time enough for all that he requires of us in any kind in this world. No duties need to jostle one another. I mean constantly. Special occasions must be determined according to special circumstances. But if in anything we take more upon us than we have time well to perform it in, without robbing God of that which is due to Him in our own souls, this God calls not to, this He blesses us not in. It is more tolerable that our duties of holiness in regard to God should entrench upon the duties of our callings and employments in this world than on the contrary. And yet neither does God require this at our hands in an ordinary manner or course. How little then will He bear with that which evidently is so much worse upon all accounts whatever, but yet through the deceitfulness of sin, thus are the souls of men beguiled. By several degrees they are at length driven from their duty. 3. It deals with a mind to draw it off from its attendance to this duty, by a tender of compensation to be made in and by other duties, as Saul thought to compensate his disobedience by sacrifice. May not the same duty be performed in public or in the family suffice? And if the soul be so foolish as not to answer, though things ought to be done and this not to be left undone, it may be ensnared and deceived. For besides the command to it, namely that we should personally watch to prayer, there are, as has been declared, a number of advantages in this duty, so performed against the deceit and efficacy of sin, which in a more public attendance to it, it has not. These sin strives to deprive the soul of by this commutation, which by its corrupt reasonings it tenders to it. 4. I may add here that which has place in all the workings of sin by deceit, namely its feeding the soul with promises and purposes of a more diligent attendance to this duty when occasions will permit. By this means it brings the soul to say unto its convictions of duty as Felix did to Paul, Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee. And by this means, oftentimes the present season and time, which alone is ours, is lost irrecoverably. These are some of the ways and means in which the deceit of sin endeavors to draw off the mind from its due attendance to this duty, which is so peculiarly suited to prevent its progress and prevalency, and which aims so directly and immediately at its ruin. I might instance also in other duties of the like tendency, but this may suffice to discover the nature of this part of the deceit of sin. And this is the first way in which it makes way for the further entangling of the affections in the conception of sin. When sin has wrought this effect on anyone, he is said to be drawn away, to be diverted from what in his mind he ought constantly to attend to in his walking before the Lord. And this will instruct us to see and discern where lies the beginning of our declensions and failings in the ways of God, and that either as to our general course or as to our attendance on special duties. And this is of great importance and concernment to us. When the beginnings and occasions of a sickness or distemper of body are known, it is a great advantage to direct in and to the cure of it. God, to recall Zion to Himself, shows her where was the beginning of her sin, Micah 1:13. Now this is that which for the most part is the beginning of sin to us, even the drawing off the mind from a due attendance to all things, to the discharge of its duty. The principal care and charge of the soul lies on the mind, and if that fail of its duty, the whole is betrayed, either as to its general frame, or as to particular miscarriages. The failing of the mind is like the failing of the watchman in Ezekiel, the whole is lost by his neglect. This, therefore, in that self-scrutiny and search which we are called to, we are most diligently to inquire after. God does not look at what duties we perform, as to their number and tale, or as to their nature merely, but whether we do them with that intention of mind and spirit which He requires. Many men perform duties in a road or course, and do not, as it were, so much as think of them. Their minds are filled with other things. Only duty takes up so much of their time. This is but an endeavor to mock God and deceive their own souls. Would you therefore take the true measure of yourselves? Consider how it is with you as to the duty of your minds which we have inquired after. Consider whether by any of the deceits mentioned you have not been diverted and drawn away, and if there be any decays upon you in any kind, you will find that there has been the beginning of them. By one way or other your minds have been made heedless, regardless, slothful, uncertain, being beguiled and drawn off from their duty. Consider the charge, Proverbs 4, verse 23, Proverbs 25 to 27. May not such a soul say, if I had attended more diligently, if I had considered more wisely the vile nature of sin, if I had not suffered my mind to be possessed with vain hopes and foolish imaginations by a cursed abuse of gospel grace, if I had not permitted it to be filled with the things of the world and to become negligent in attending to special duties, I had not at this day been thus sick, weak, thriftless, wounded, decayed, defiled. My careless, my deceived mind has been the beginning of sin and transgression unto my soul. And this discovery will direct the soul to a suitable way for its healing and recovery, which will never be affected by a multiplying of particular duties, but by a restoring of the mind, Psalm 23, verse 3. And this also does hence appear to be the great means of preserving our souls, both as to their general frame and particular duties according to the mind and will of God, namely to endeavor after a sound and steadfast mind. It is a signal grace to have the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind, 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. A stable, solid, resolved mind in the things of God, not easily moved, diverted, changed, not drawn aside, a mind not apt to hearken after corrupt reasonings, vain insinuations or pretenses to draw it off from its duty. This is that which the apostle exhorts believers to, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. The steadfastness of our minds abiding in their duty is the cause of all our unmovableness and fruitfulness and obedience. And so Peter tells us that those who are by any means led away or enticed, they fall from their own steadfastness, 2 Peter 3, verse 17. And the great blame that is laid upon backsliders is that they are not steadfast. Psalm 78, verse 37, their heart was not steadfast. For if the soul be safe, unless the mind be drawn off from its duty, the soundness and steadfastness of the mind is its great preservative. And there are three parts of the steadfastness of the mind. First, a full purpose of cleaving to God in all things. Secondly, a daily renovation and quickening of the heart to a discharge of this purpose. Thirdly, resolutions against all dalliances or parleys about negligences in that discharge, which are not here to be spoken to. End of chapter 9. A Treatise on Indwelling Sin by John Owen.